This is my zine. I'd like to read you something that you may have heard before. It was first published in Teacher Magazine back in 1990, and I'm going to read from a republication in Native American Smoke Signals, April 1993, where it's titled, An Indian Father's Plea, Don't Label My Son a Slow Learner. It's by Robert Lake. Dear teacher, I would like to introduce you to my son, Wind Wolf. He is probably what you would consider a typical Indian kid. He was born and raised on the reservation. He has black hair, dark brown eyes, and an olive complexion. And like so many Indian children his age, he is shy and quiet in the classroom. He is 5 years old, in kindergarten, and I can't understand why you have already labeled him a slow learner. At the age of 5, he has already been through quite an education compared with his peers in Western society. As his first introduction into this world, he was bonded to his mother and to the Mother Earth in a traditional Native childbirth ceremony. And he has been continuously cared for by his mother, father, sisters, cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and extended tribal family since this ceremony. From his mother's warm and loving arms, Wind Wolf was placed in a secure and specially designed Indian baby basket. His father and the medicine elders conducted another ceremony with him that served to bond him with the essence of his genetic father, the Great Spirit, the grandfather's son, and the grandmother moon. This was all done to introduce him properly into the new and natural world, not the world of artificiality, and to protect his sensitive and delicate soul. It is our people's way of showing the newborn respect, ensuring that he starts his life on the path of spirituality. The traditional Indian baby basket became his turtle shell and served as the first seat for his classroom. He was strapped in for safety, protected from injury by the willow roots and hazelwood construction. The basket was made by a tribal elder who had gathered her materials with prayer and in a ceremonial way. It is the same kind of basket that our people have used for thousands of years. It is specially designed to provide the child with the kind of knowledge and experience he will need to survive in his culture and environment. Wind Wolf was strapped in snugly with a deliberate restriction upon his arms and legs. Although you in Western society may argue that such a method serves to hinder motor skill development and abstract reasoning, we believe it forces the child to first develop his intuitive faculties, rational intellect, symbolic thinking, and five senses. Wind Wolf was with his mother constantly, closely bonded physically, as she carried him on her back or held him in front while breastfeeding. She carried him everywhere she went, and every night he slept with both parents. Because of this, Wind Wolf's educational setting was not only a secure environment, but it was also very colorful, complicated, sensitive, and diverse. He has been with his mother at the ocean at daybreak when she made her prayers and gathered fresh seaweed from the rocks. He has sat with his uncles in a rowboat on the river while they fished with gill nets, and he has watched and listened to elders as they told creation stories and animal legends and sang songs around the campfires. He has attended the sacred and ancient white deerskin dance of his people and is well acquainted with the cultures and languages of other tribes. He has been with his mother when she gathered herbs for healing and watched his tribal aunts and grandmothers gather and prepare traditional foods such as acorn, smoked salmon, eel, and deer meat. He has played with abalone shells, pine nuts, iris grass string, and leather while watching the women make beaded jewelry and traditional Native regalia. He has had many opportunities to watch his father, uncles, and ceremonial leaders use different kinds of colorful feathers and sing different songs, different kinds of songs, while preparing for the sacred dances and rituals. As he grew older, Windwolf began to crawl out of the baby basket, develop his motor skills, and explore the world around him. When frightened or sleepy, he could always return to the basket, as a turtle withdraws into its shell. Such an inward journey allows one to reflect in privacy on what he has learned and to carry the new knowledge deeply into the unconscious and the soul. Shapes, sizes, colors, texture, sound, smell, feeling, taste, and the learning process are therefore functionally integrated. The physical and spiritual, matter and energy, conscious and unconscious, individual and social. This kind of learning goes beyond the basics of distinguishing the difference between rough and smooth, square and round, hard and soft, black and white, similarities and extremes. For example, Windwolf was with his mother in South Dakota while she danced for 7 days straight in the hot sun, fasting and piercing herself in the sacred Sundance ceremony of a distant tribe. He has been doctored in a number of different healing ceremonies by medicine men and women from diverse places ranging from Alaska and Arizona to New York and California. He has been in more than 20 different sacred sweat lodge rituals used by native tribes to purify mind, body, and soul since he was 3 years old, and he has already been exposed to many different religions of his racial brothers, Protestant, Catholic, Asian Buddhist, and Tibetan Lamaist. It takes a long time to absorb and reflect on these kinds of experiences, so maybe that is why you think my Indian child is a slow learner. His aunts and grandmothers taught him to count and know his numbers while they sorted out the complex materials used to make the abstract designs in the native baskets. He listened to his mother count each and every bead and sort out numerically according to color while she painstakingly made complex beaded belts and necklaces. He learned his basic numbers by helping his father count and sort the rocks to be used in the sweat lodge. 7 rocks for a medicine sweat, say, or 13 for the summer solstice ceremony. The rocks are later heated and doused with water to create purifying steam. And he was taught to learn mathematics by counting the sticks we use in our traditional native hand game. So I realize he may be slow in grasping the methods and tools that you are now using in your classroom, ones quite familiar to his white peers, but I hope you will be patient with him. It takes time to adjust to a new cultural system and learn new things. He is not culturally disadvantaged, but he is culturally different. If you ask him how many months there are in a year, he will probably tell you 13. He will respond this way not because he doesn't know how to count properly, but because he has been taught by our traditional people that there are 13 full moons in a year according to the native tribal calendar, and that there are really 13 plants in our solar system and 13 tail feathers on a perfectly balanced eagle, the most powerful kind of bird to use in ceremony and healing. But he also knows that some eagles may only have 12 tail feathers, or 7, that they do not all have the same number. He knows that the flicker has exactly 10 tail feathers. They are red and black, representing the directions of east and west, life and death, and that this bird is considered a fire bird, a power used in native doctoring and healing. He can probably count more than 40 different kinds of birds, tell you and his peers what kind of bird each is and where it lives, the seasons in which it appears, and how it is used in a sacred ceremony. He may have trouble writing his name on a piece of paper, but he knows how to say it and many other things in several different Indian languages. He is not fluent yet because he is only 5 years old and required by law to attend your educational system, learn your language, your values, your ways of thinking, and your methods of teaching and learning. So you see, all of these influences together make him somewhat shy and quiet, and perhaps slow according to your standards. But if Windwolf was not prepared for his first tentative foray into your world, neither were you appreciative of his culture. On the first day of class, you had difficulty with his name. You wanted to call him Wind, insisting that Wolf somehow must be his middle name. The students in the class laughed at him, causing further embarrassment. While you were trying to teach him your new methods, helping him learn new tools for self-discovery and adapt to his new learning environment, he may be looking out the window as if daydreaming. Why? Because he has been taught to watch and study the changes in nature. It is hard for him to make the appropriate psychic switch from the right to the left hemisphere of the brain when he sees the leaves turning bright colors, and the geese heading south, and the squirrel scurrying around for nuts to get ready for a harsh winter. In his heart, in his young mind, and almost by instinct, he knows that this is the time of year he is supposed to be with his people, gathering and preparing fish, deer meat, and native plants and herbs, and learning his assigned tasks in this role. He is caught between two worlds, torn by two distinct cultural systems. Yesterday, for the third time in 2 weeks, he came home crying and said he wanted to have his hair cut. He said he doesn't have any friends at school because they make fun of his long hair. I tried to explain to him that in our culture, long hair is a sign of masculinity and balance and is a source of power, but he remained adamant in his position. To make matters worse, he recently encountered his first harsh case of racism. Windwolf had managed to adopt at least one good school friend. On the way home from school one day, he asked his new pal if he wanted to come home to play with him until supper. That was okay with Windwolf's mother, who was walking with them. When they all got to the little friend's house, the two boys ran inside to ask permission while Windwolf's mother waited. But the other boy's mother lashed out. "It is okay if you have to play with him at school, but we don't allow those kind of people in our house." When my wife asked why not, the other boy's mother answered, "Because you are Indians and we are white, and I don't want my kids growing up with your kind of people." So now my young Indian child does not want to go to school anymore, even though we cut his hair. He feels that he does not belong. He is the only Indian child in your class, and he is well aware of this fact. Instead of being proud of his race, heritage, and culture, he feels ashamed. When he watches television, he asks why the white people hate us so much and always kill our people in the movies, and why they take everything away from us. He asks why the other kids in school are not taught about the power, beauty, and essence of nature, or provided with an opportunity to experience the world around them firsthand. He says he hates living in the city and that he misses his Indian cousins and friends. He asks why one white girl at school, who is a friend, always tells him, "I like you, Windwolf, because you are a good Indian." Now he refuses to sing his native songs, play with his Indian artifacts, learn his language, or participate in his sacred ceremonies. When I ask him to go to an urban powwow or help me with a sacred sweat lodge ritual, he says no, because that's weird, and he doesn't want his friends at school to think he doesn't believe in God. So, dear teacher, I want to introduce you to my son, Windwolf, who is not really a typical kid after all. He stems from a long line of hereditary chiefs, medicine men and women, and ceremonial leaders whose accomplishments and unique forms of knowledge are still being studied and recorded in contemporary books. He has 7 different tribal systems flowing through his blood. He is even part white. I want my child to succeed in school and in life. I don't want him to be a dropout or juvenile delinquent or to end up on drugs and alcohol because he is made to feel inferior or because of discrimination. I want him to be proud of his rich heritage and culture, and I would like him to develop the necessary capabilities to adapt to and succeed in both cultures, but I need your help. What you say and what you do in the classroom, what you teach and how you teach it, and what you don't say and don't teach will have a significant effect on the potential success or failure of my child. Please remember that this is the primary year of his education and development. All I ask is that you work with me, not against me, to help educate my child in the best way. If you don't have the knowledge, preparation, experience, or training to effectively deal with culturally different children, I am willing to help you with the few resources I have available, or direct you to such resources. Millions of dollars have been appropriated by Congress and are being spent each year for Indian education. All you have to do is take advantage of it and encourage your school to make an effort to use it in the name of equal education. My Indian child has a constitutional right to learn, retain, and maintain his heritage and culture. By the same token, I strongly believe that non-Indian children also have a constitutional right to learn about our Native American heritage and culture, because Indians play a significant part in the history of Western society. Until this reality is equally understood and applied in education as a whole, there will be a lot more school children in grades K through 12 identified as slow learners. My son, Windwolf, is not an empty glass coming into your class to be filled. He is a full basket coming into a different environment and society with something special to share. Please let him share his knowledge, heritage, and culture with you and his peers. Those are the words of Robert Lake, an instructor in the Native American Studies program at Eastern Montana College at Billings. And this article was first printed in the September 1990 issue of Teacher Magazine and reprinted in the April 1993 issue of Native American Smoke Signals. Lake was living in Spokane, Washington, when his son first went to kindergarten, and he says he was, in a separate article, he says he was frustrated with the behavior and the actions of the teachers in Spokane. Everybody pays their share in taxes, right? Well, you know that can't be true. An investigation by the International Herald Tribune and Corporate Crime Reporter reveals that between 1996 and 1998, 41 major U.S. corporations not only avoided paying taxes, they received checks from the Internal Revenue Service for $3.2 billion in rebates. Texaco reported $3.4 billion in profits and got $304 million in federal rebates over a three-year period. 24 corporations, including Kmart, Enron, Pfizer, PepsiCo, J.P. Morgan, and Colgate-Palmolive, collected IRS checks worth $1.3 billion. Microsoft and Cisco Systems paid no taxes in 1999. For more information, Corporate Crime Reporter has a website, ccr.org. Here's an interesting piece about where our society may be going, written by Amy Webb of Columbia News Service and reprinted in The Oregonian in 2001. New York. Sandra Lederman decided at age 46 that she wanted children. Her doctor told her she couldn't conceive and urged her to find an egg donor. Lederman of Houston placed an ad in the student newspaper at Columbia University. She offered to pay a donor $25,000. "We targeted Columbia because my husband and I are selective, and we know that the university is selective," she said. Lederman is one of a growing number of Americans seeking elite human eggs. In response, many college-age women are selling their eggs to pay their tuition. Buying and selling eggs is legal because human eggs are classified by federal law as tissue rather than organs. Gregory Kabnick said, he is editor of the Hastings Center Report, a journal published by the Hastings Center for Bioethics. Kabnick said no state has restricted payments for eggs, but some states limit the number of times a woman may donate. A recent ad in the Harvard Crimson, that's Harvard University's daily newspaper, read, $50,000 for Jewish egg donor. Another offered $25,000 for an egg donor with at least a 1500 SAT score. An ad like that compelled Jennifer to undergo the procedure. She spoke on condition that her last name not be used because she has exceeded the legal donation limit in her state. She has made $70,000 for 8 procedures and paid for her Ivy League law degree. Many of the women who answer ads aren't aware of the extensive procedure and potential dangers associated with donating eggs, said Karen Sinisio, co-owner and director of the Center for Surrogate Parenting and Egg Donation in Beverly Hills, California. This is a highly regimented process involving weekly donor appointments in the beginning and daily visits towards the end. There is a lot involved here, she said. Once a donor has been selected and undergone mental and physical testing, she begins drug therapy to synchronize the donor's and recipient's menstrual cycles. Once both women's cycles are coordinated, the donor begins a second round of therapy, taking daily self-injections to stimulate her ovaries so that she produces 12 eggs. When her ovaries are ripe, the donor's eggs are harvested. The doctor usually administers a local anesthetic and then extracts the eggs through the uterus. It really hurts to go through all of this, but it's exhausting to have all of those drugs in my system, Jennifer said. You go through symptoms of menopause, fatigue and hot flashes. It's hard, but I'm not planning on having any children of my own, and I know that I'm helping people, and I need the money. Rebecca Dresser, professor of law and ethics in medicine at Washington University, said, there is concern as the price for eggs increases. Eggs shouldn't be the commodity here. A woman's effort should be treated as the commodity. That was by Amy Webb of Columbia News Service, published in The Oregonian in 2001. The Quiet of the Backstretch by David Helwig. Pinette Raceway is hidden in a small patch of woods not far from our big frame house. You get there by turning down a clay road just past Mike's Lobster Pound on the Trans-Canada Highway, about 40 kilometers east of Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. There's a handmade sign for the track, the outline of a horse, driver, and sulky. The raceway has a wooden grandstand, a frame building with a snack bar, and, farther off, a longer, lower building with stalls for the horses. Everything is painted white with green trim. The oval of the track is the red ochre of Prince Edward Island earth. When you climb into the grandstand, you look across at a stand of tall spruce that runs half the length of the backstretch. The other half opens across fields to the shining surface of the Pinette River. Sometimes I have seen the quick, short beat of an osprey's wings as it circles over the water, hunting, waiting to dive. On the quiet of the backstretch between races, I have seen a fox trot by on its dainty feet out of the spruce woods and back in. Most of those who come to the track live close by. A girl of 16 takes your dollar admission on the way in, and a few minutes later, she turns up in the grandstand selling tickets for the night's raffle. There's no rush to the betting windows here. There are no betting windows. No purse for the winner, either. The races are just for the fun of racing, for the pleasure of seeing the long, delicate legs moving in harmony, pulling the slender wheels of the carts twice around the oval. When they want to groom the track after the first couple of races, a tractor pulls out from behind the horse barn with the trunk of a good-sized spruce tree on a chain behind it, and the log is dragged over the bright earth to level it. The snack bar has hot dogs and chips and homemade muffins, sold by the kind of women you might run into at a church tea. In fact, the worlds aren't far apart. A woman just along the row in the grandstand is talking about a minister she's just heard, some kind of Baptist, she's certain. She could tell by the way he preached, and as the horses in the third race battle toward the wire, the announcer calls out, "Sing your favorite hymns." A Wednesday evening, and we are sitting in the stands. It is late summer, the end of the season. A chill is in the air. One of the horsemen, a familiar face from earlier Wednesdays, jokes that he's coming up into the seats to get warm. "That one's a good little goer," he says of a 2-year-old pacing down the backstretch. No one comments, and he says it again. "That one's a good little goer." The race card is not planned too much in advance. A driver will stop his horse in front of the grandstand to shout up to the race announcer the name of a new arrival, then tell those of us watching that he has to go back to the stables to get his whip since someone's mislaid it. Between races, the driver who won the first appears among the spectators, still in the helmet, which is his only racing gear. He's a small, thin man with a smiling face. When they find themselves short of entries for the third race, he takes his horse out again. He wins again. Tonight, the second race had only 2 horses in it, and neither driver was carrying a whip. You could hear their voices across the darkening air, shouting encouragement at the horses as they came down the home stretch. There are no lights on the Pinette track, so the races have to be over before dark comes up out of the east, over the river and the tall trees. Will there be races next week? Maybe, but the days are getting short. The air is sharp with cold. After the last race, everyone is quick to get up and move to the cars. The sun is setting over the cove at Pinette, and the beach where we dug clams in the summer is empty. At this time of year, the lobster boats are brought ashore and set on blocks to pass the winter, then to be painted and cleaned up when the weather warms up in spring. It is part of the poetry of fall here, the boats appearing in the yards of houses down every country road. Soon, they'll be taking down the sign announcing the races, but in a few months, when the ice is out, among the other signs of spring on the island, the horses will be back, their hooves banging along over the red earth. That was written by David Helwig, a poet who lives on Prince Edward Island, Canada. It was published in Canadian Geographic Magazine, the September-October 1998 issue. Just a view of life in a rural area. Here's something about old age. The Open Cage by Anzia Jezierska. I live in a massive, outmoded apartment house, converted for roomers, a once fashionable residence now swarming with 6 times as many people as it was built for. 300 of us cook our solitary meals on 2-burner gas stoves in our dingy, furnished rooms. We slide past each other in the narrow hallways on our way to the community bathrooms, or up and down the stairs, without speaking. But in our rooms, with doors closed, we are never really alone. We are invaded by the sounds of living around us, water gurgling in the sinks of neighboring rooms, the harsh slamming of a door, a shrill voice on the hall telephone, the radio from upstairs colliding with the television set next door. Worse than the racket of the radios are the smells of cooking mixing with the odors of dusty carpets, and the unventilated accumulation left by the roomers who preceded us. These stale layers of smells seep under the closed door. I keep the window open in the coldest weather to escape the smells. Sometimes, after a long wait for the bathroom, you get inside only to find that the last person left the bathtub dirty. and sometimes the man whose room is right next to the bath and who works nights gets so angry with the people who wake him up taking their morning baths that he hides the bathtub stopper. One morning, I hurried to take my bath while the tub was still clean, only to find that the stopper was missing. I rushed angrily back to my room and discovered I had locked myself out. The duplicate key was downstairs in the office, and I was still in my bathrobe with a towel around my neck. I closed my eyes like an ostrich, not to be seen by anyone, and started down the stairway. While getting the key, I found a letter in my mailbox. As soon as I was inside my room, I reached for my glasses on the desk. They weren't there. I searched the desk drawers, the bureau drawers, the shelf by the sink. Finally, in despair, I searched the pockets of my clothes. All at once I realized that I had lost my letter, too. In that moment of fury, I felt like kicking and screaming at my failing memory. The outrage of being old. Old and feeble-minded, in a house where the man down the hall revenges himself on his neighbors. Where rumor hates rumor, because each one hates himself for being trapped in this house that's not a home, but a prison where the soul dies long before the body is dead. My glance, striking the mirror, fixed on a frightened stare at the absurd old face looking at me. I tore off the eye shade and saw the narrowing slits where eyes had been. Damn the man who hid the bathtub stopper. Damn them all. There was a tap at the door, and I ignored it. The tapping went on. I kicked open the door at the intruder, but no one was there. I took my ready-made printed sign, "Busy, please do not disturb," and hung it on the door. The tapping began again. No, no, no one at the door. It was something stirring in the farthest corner of the molding. I moved toward it. A tiny bird, wings hunched together, fluttered helplessly. I jumped back at the terrible fear of something alive and wild in my room. My God, I told myself, it's only a little bird. Why am I so scared? With a whirring of wings, the bird landed on the window frame. I wanted to push it out to freedom, but I was too afraid to touch it. For a moment, I couldn't move. But I couldn't bear to be in the same room with that frightened little bird. I rushed out to Sadie Williams. A few times, when her door was open, I had seen parakeets flying freely about the room. I had often overheard her love talk to her birds, who responded to her like happy children to their mother. "Mama loves baby. Baby loves mama. Come, honey bunch. Come, darling Tweedledee Tweedledum. Bonnie boy, dearest, come for your bath." Her room was only a few doors away, and yet she had never invited me in. But now I banged on her door, begging for help. "Who is it?" she shouted. "For God's sake," I cried, "a bird flew into my room. It's stuck by the window. It can't fly out." In an instant she had brushed past me into my room. "Where's the bird?" she demanded. "My God," I cried, "where is it? Where is it? It must have flown out." Sadie moved to the open window. "Poor darling," she said, "it must have fallen out. Why didn't you call me sooner?" Before I could tell her anything, she was gone. I sat down, hurt by her unfriendliness. The vanished bird left a strange silence in the room. Why was I so terrified of the helpless little thing? I might have given it a drink of water, a few crumbs of bread. I might have known what to do if only I had not lost my glasses, if that brute of a man hadn't hid the bathtub stopper. A sudden whirring of wings crashed into my thoughts. The bird peered at me from the molding. I fled to Sadie Williams. "Come quick," I begged. "The bird! The bird!" Sadie burst into my room ahead of me. There it was peering at us from the farthest corner of the molding. "Chickadee, chickadee-dee-dee-dee," Sadie crooned, cupping her hands toward the bird. "Come, Fee-Fee, darling. Come, honey." On tiptoes, she inched closer, 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 cooing in that same bird voice, until at last, in one quick, deft movement, she cupped the frightened bird in her hands. "Fee, fee, darling," Sadie caressed it with a finger, holding it to her large breast. "I'll put you into the guest cage. It's just been cleaned for you." Without consulting me, she carried the bird to her room. A little cage with fresh water was ready. Shooing away her parakeets, she gently placed the bird on the swing and closed the cage. "Take a little water, Fee Fee dear," she coaxed. "I'll get you some seed you'll like." With a nimble leap, the bird alighted on the floor of the cage and dipped its tiny beak into the water. "It drinks! It drinks!" I cried joyfully. "Oh, Sadie, you've saved my baby bird." "Shh," she admonished, and I went on gratefully, "You're wonderful, wonderful." "Shut up, you're scaring the bird." "Forgive me," I implored in a lower voice. "So much has happened to me this morning, and the bird scared me. Poor thing, but I'm not dressed. May I leave my baby with you for a while longer? You know so well how to handle it." Back in my room, I dressed hurriedly. Why did I never dream that anything so wonderful as this bird would come to me? Is it because I never had a pet as a child that this bird meant so much to me in the loneliness of old age? This morning I did not know of its existence, and now it had become my only kin on earth. I shared its frightened helplessness away from its kind. Suddenly I felt jealous of Sadie caring for my bird, lest it get fonder of her than of me. But I was afraid to annoy her by coming back too soon. So I set to work to give my room a thorough cleaning to ensure a happy home for my bird. I swept the floor, and before I could gather up the sweepings in the dustpan, another shower of loose plaster came raining down. How could I clean up the dinginess, the dirt, in the stained walls? An overwhelming need to be near my bird made me drop my cleaning and go to Sadie. I knocked at the door. There was no answer, so I barged in. Sadie was holding the tiny thing in her cupped hands, breathing into it, moaning anxiously. "Fee, fee, darling." Stunned with apprehension, I watched her slowly surrendering the bird into the cage. "What's the matter?" I clutched her arm. "It won't eat. It only took a sip of water. It's starving, but it's too frightened to eat. We'll have to let it go." "It's my bird," I pleaded. "It came to me. I won't let it go." "It's dying. Do you want it to die?" "Why is it dying?" I cried, bewildered. "It's a wild bird. It has to be free." I was too stunned to argue. "Go get your hat and coat. We're going to Riverside Drive." My bird in her cage, I had no choice but to follow her out into the park. In a grove full of trees, Sadie stopped and rested the cage on a thick bush. As she moved her hand, I grabbed the cage and had it in my arms before either of us knew what I had done. "It's so small," I pleaded, tightening my arms around the cage. "It'll only get lost again. Who'll take care of it?" "Don't be a child," she said coldly. "Birds are smarter than you." Then in afterthought, she added, "You know what you need? You need to buy yourself a parakeet. Afterwards, I'll go with you to the pet store and help you pick a bird that'll talk to you and love you." A bought bird? I was shocked. A bird bought to love me? She knew so much about birds and so little about my feelings. "My bird came to me from the sky," I told her. "It came to my window of all the windows of the neighborhood." Sadie lifted the cage out of my arms and put it back on the bush. "Now, watch and see," she said. She opened the cage door and very gently took the bird out, holding it in her hand and looking down at it. "You mustn't let it go," I said. "You mustn't." She didn't pay any attention to me, just opened her fingers slowly. I wanted to stop her, but instead I watched. For a moment, the little bird stayed where it was. Then Sadie said something softly, lovingly, and lifted her hand with the bird on it. There was a flutter, a spread of wings, and then the sudden strong freedom of a bird returning to its sky. I cried out, "Look, it's flying!" My frightened baby bird, soaring so sure of itself, lifted me out of my body. I felt myself flying with it, and I stood there staring, watching it go higher and higher. I lifted my arms, flying with it. I saw it now, not only with sharpened eyesight, but with sharpened senses of love. Even as it vanished into the sky, I rejoiced in its power to go beyond me. I said aloud, exulting, "It's free!" I looked at Sadie. Whatever I had thought of her, she was the one who had known what the little bird needed. All the other times I had seen her, she had remembered only herself, but with the bird, she forgot. Now, with the empty cage in her hand, she turned to go back to the apartment house we had left. I followed her. We were leaving the bird behind us, and we were going back into our own cage. I want to read a couple of pieces about landmines. Landmines are a particularly awful weapon. They're all around the world. There are something like 10 million of them in the ground in many countries that have had wars in the last several decades. They're produced in the U.S. and other countries. They're buried by the U.S. and other countries. I'm going to focus, however, not quite so much on injuries and deaths of people, but on other species and their relation to landmines. First, here's a piece from the Oregonian, May 7th, 2000. Wild and domestic animals are casualties of landmines. About 25,000 people are injured or killed each year by landmines, and studies indicate the critter toll is far higher. This piece is by Grant Peck of the Associated Press, reporting from Bangkok, Thailand. The protesters of the 1960s, who proclaimed that war is unhealthy for children and other living things, didn't know the half of it. It took an unlucky 38-year-old elephant to remind the world that war's most persistent legacy, millions of landmines scattered and forgotten, also menaces the animal kingdom. When Motola the logging elephant lost a foot to a landmine on the Thai-Myanmar border last August, it made headlines, but only because her trainer took her to a special elephant hospital in northern Thailand. Countless other hapless, smaller beasts die unremarked in the wild. Landmines have become almost synonymous with modern warfare. An estimated 110 million of the life-threatening traps are buried in 64 countries around the world. About 25,000 people are injured or killed every year by mines, and studies suggest the toll on animals is 10 to 20 times as high. Removal is a slow and expensive process. Typically, the biggest concentrations of mines are found in countries with the least amount of resources to deal with them, places like Cambodia and Afghanistan. From a human perspective, if your herds are being decimated or your pack animals killed, your livelihood is threatened, said Kevin Stewart, an animal rights activist in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. But more importantly, the animals have as much right not to be randomly blown up as humans do. Because the wealth of rural households is often vested in domestic animals and livestock, the issue of animal casualties is not just sentimental. It is well documented that land forced to remain fallow because of mines causes significant drops in agricultural production and farmers' incomes. The loss of animals often affects the same farmers, worsening their economic plight. A study of Bosnia, Afghanistan, Cambodia, and Mozambique, published in 1995, found that the 32,000-plus households surveyed lost a total of 54,000 animals at an average cash equivalent loss of $200 to each household. That's the average annual income in some countries. Wild animals, including endangered species, probably have it worse, although no major systematic studies have been done on the question, Stewart said. Veterinarian Elijah Furkovic, who studied the effects of the 1991-95 war in Croatia on domesticated and wild animals, found that at least 57 of an estimated population of 400 European brown bears died from war-related causes, a quarter of them from landmines or artillery fire. Three-legged bears are still seen around, one of his colleagues, Duro Huber, said. In most places, the issue of animal casualties surfaces only in the occasional news story, such as reports that mines on the India-China border are killing endangered animals such as the Tibetan gazelle, Tibetan wild ass, blue sheep, alpine musk deer, and the snow leopard. Eastern and southern Africa, home to some of the world's most spectacular wildlife, have seen animal populations devastated by several rounds of brutal human conflict. Only recently have South Africa and Zimbabwe begun to cope with the landmines left over from liberation struggles in the 1970s and 80s. Large-scale clearance of mines began just in 1997-98 at the well-known Zimbabwean tourist destination of Victoria Falls, where dozens of people have been killed. Elephants have been landmine victims in Mozambique, Angola, and Zimbabwe, which suffered bitter civil wars. In Asia, Sri Lanka's long-running civil war has claimed as many as 20 elephants a year from landmine blasts. The ethnic conflicts that embroiled Uganda and Rwanda last decade started a new open season on Central Africa's wildlife. Many of the gentle gorillas in the mist, made famous by the late Diane Fossey, were caught in the fighting. One mine victim, known well to naturalists, was Mkono, a male silverback gorilla from the Great Lakes area of Uganda, Rwanda, and Congo. The area, covering about 150 square miles, is home to about half of the 650 mountain gorillas left in the world. Mkono died in northwestern Rwanda in November 1994. He was 20 years old and had already lost a hand to a poacher's snare. Stewart's World Wide Web project of landmines and animals is named after him. Tigers targeted. Other wildlife suffered in the war's aftermath, becoming victims of poachers able to operate freely in the climate of lawlessness that accompanied the breakdown of society. In Southeast Asia, a similar breakdown of authority in Cambodia, slow to recover from more than two decades of armed conflict, has allowed poachers free rein. Last year, it was reported that they were using mines to kill tigers. The crude, homemade mines used in tiger traps in a vast wildlife sanctuary led park rangers to conclude that soldiers trained in guerrilla warfare were doing the hunting. Most are former government military and ex-Khmer Rouge fighters, said Chai Samith of Cambodia's Environment Ministry. The soldiers hunted the cats to sell their bones to make traditional Asian medicines, he said. Tiger skins also fetch a high price in the illegal wildlife trade. Other animals also have become the deliberate targets of landmines, although for less greedy reasons. There have been reports from several areas that livestock were driven across fields as a low-tech method of clearing mines. Sheep were reportedly used during the Iran-Iraq War and in Bosnia, pigs in El Salvador, and cattle in Zimbabwe. Some animal rights activists deplore the use of dogs to sniff out mines because of the chance for accidents. At least one German shepherd died in mine clearance operations in Bosnia in an explosion that also killed his handler. That piece was by Grant Peck of the Associated Press, printed in the Oregonian, May 7, 2000. And by focusing on this issue, I certainly don't mean to demean or to lessen concern for the issue of humans killed or injured by landmines. But a couple of other related pieces. One from the Whole Earth Review about the invention of a Fire Ant Landmine Destroyer, made in the United Kingdom. It says, landmines are a nasty piece of human ingenuity. Efforts to ban them continue. In the meantime, millions remain in place, poised to kill and maim. No one knows how many landmines lie buried throughout the world, but estimates range from 85 to 110 million. Every week, they kill or injure another 500 people, 90% of them unarmed civilians, of whom 30% are children. The British Defense Evaluation and Research Agency, or DERA, created Fire Ant as a safe, cost-effective mine-clearing tool. The Fire Ant is placed close to the mine. After remote ignition, electronically or by fuse, its 1500 degree centigrade flame burns through the mine's thin metal or plastic casing and burns the explosive and the detonator without triggering the mine. The Fire Ant itself uses an igniter rather than a detonator and contains no high explosives. It's designed to be safe to handle and store, with no intrinsic value to terrorists or criminals. And this piece from Earth Island Journal from Slovenia in Eastern Europe, titled Mine Dogs to the Rescue. Humans suffer horribly from landmines, one of the least civilized weapons ever devised. According to the Humane Society of the U.S., more than 55,000 animals have been killed by mines in Afghanistan, Bosnia, Cambodia, and Mozambique. Mines also cause long-term damage to land and water by toxic contamination. In September 1999, the first worldwide mine dog workshop was held in Ljubljana, Slovenia, to evaluate developments in the promising field of human-dog mine detection teams. The dogs detect mines by scent from a relatively safe distance, and human team members handle the actual removal. Dog-human teams can clear mines at least 10 times faster than any other method. Dog's sense of smell is approximately 10,000 times better than humans. They can be trained to smell something as specific as a landmine. And I learned that information about their sense of smell in a book called Dogs That Work, a wonderful book if you're a dog lover. Believe it or not, I'm going to read a column from Dear Abby, Abigail Van Buren. She received this letter. I have been retired from teaching for many years and would like to share a lesson I learned that stands out in my memory like no other. I was young and teaching math at the junior high school level. We had worked hard on a new concept all week, and the students were very stressed. They were frowning, frustrated, and carping at one another and me. Wanting to stop the crankiness before it got out of hand, I asked the students in the room to take out two sheets of paper and list the names of the other students in the room, leaving a space between each name. Then I told them to think of the nicest thing they could say about each of their classmates and write it down. It took the remainder of the class period to finish the assignment. When the students handed me the papers and left, they seemed more relaxed. That weekend, I wrote the name of each student on a separate sheet of paper and listed what the students had said about that individual. On Monday, I gave each student his or her list. Before long, everyone was smiling. "Really?" I heard one whisper. "I never knew that meant anything to anyone." Another, "I didn't know anyone liked me that much." The assignment was never mentioned again, but it didn't matter because the exercise had accomplished its purpose. The students felt better about themselves and one another. Years later, I was asked to attend the funeral of one of those students, a promising young man, even when I taught him in junior high school. I was deeply saddened by his untimely death in Vietnam. The church was packed with Mark's friends, many of whom had been his classmates and students of mine. After the funeral, I and many of Mark's former classmates were invited to his parents' house. They approached me and said, "We want to show you something." Mark was carrying this when he was killed. His father pulled something from a wallet. It was the list of all the good things Mark's classmates had said about him. "Thank you so much for doing that," Mark's mother said. "As you can see, Mark treasured it." A group of Mark's classmates overheard the exchange. One smiled sheepishly and said, "I still have my list. It's in my top desk drawer at home." Another said, "I have mine too. It's in my diary." I put mine in our wedding album," said a third. "I bet we all saved them," said a fourth. "I carry mine with me at all times." That's when I finally sat down and cried. The lesson my former students taught me that day became a standard in every class I taught for the rest of my teaching career. And this letter to Dear Abby was signed Sister H.P.M., St. Paul, Minnesota.